My next guest's new book is called... Oh, hold on a second. Let me do something. No, here we go. I don't even know where to start with my next guest because I feel like I've known her since she was 10 years old.
That's because you have. That's why. Maybe like 12. Yeah,
my guest tonight at the big table is a homegrown artist, poet, commentator, and sociologist. Chicago Magazine once warned us all by saying, ignore Eve Ewing at your own intellectual, political, and cultural peril. Wow, that's a quote. Eve Ewing just put out a brand new book of poetry called Electric Arches. Actually, to call it a book of poetry is limiting because it's really poetry, art, and short stories. It's her debut effort. Ewing is a leading voice in Chicago for issues of social justice. The former CPS teacher graduated from UFC. Got her PhD from Harvard, and now is back at the University of Chicago School of Social Service Administration. A longtime advocate and voice for the voiceless, Eve Ewing continues to push boundaries and establish new narratives about the city and the world that we live in. It's my pleasure to have Dr. Eve Ewing at the big table tonight. I can't even say I'm intimidated. I told Pete I'm intimidated.
Oh, you're so silly. This table is so big, so we're both equally intimidated. You're like 30 feet away.
My first question for you is, how's your mom?
She's good. I texted her and I said, oh, you know, tune in. I'm going to be with Justin on the radio. She said, cool, I'm watching Game of Thrones.
She just
discovered Game of Thrones like this year. Yeah, and she finished the first season and she texted me and she's like, that was great. I hope there's a second season. I was like, this show has been on since like the Clinton administration. But it's great. It's really fun watching her.
Well, you know, it's great to have you here. Let's talk about the book. I mean, it's amazing to me because you wear so many hats. You know, I've always known you as a poet, as someone who's coming up in Chicago and through your time at University of Chicago and paying attention to you on social media.
Thanks.
You have developed yourself as not just a poet, but like I said, an advocate. You've been a teacher. You speak well on Chicago school reform, things of those nature. I mean, where do you see yourself? Are you a commentator first, a poet? Where do you sort of classify yourself as a voice?
Yeah, that's a great question. I really don't, actually. A good friend of mine who Hanif Abdurraqib, who also has a book coming out this fall, he just gave this interview where he said, I say I'm a multi-genre writer because that's what they tell me I am. And that's sort of how I feel. You know, I'm blessed to love a lot of things. I have a lot of passions. And I just kind of let that guide me. And the terrible news is that there are so many bad things happening in Chicago and around the world so many times, you know, all the time that I'm never short of things to write about or think about.
Well, it plays out in Electric Arches. The Chicago plays a main character in this book.
Yeah, much so.
Talk about that, because you grew up in Chicago. You grew up in Logan Square.
Yeah,
different Logan
Square,
as we know now.
Yeah. I am a time traveler from a non-existent Logan Square. The Logan Square of the 90s.
How much of this book, poetry of prose, of fiction, short stories, how much of it comes from, like, your entire life? I mean, have you been working to this point?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the whole book is, it's a coming of age story, you know? And so my hope is that it's true. It's like true things that happened in my life. But of course, I hope that it'll also speak to broad audiences beyond me and beyond people that can identify with my own experience. And I feel like now that I have kind of gotten a lot of these things out, I've also sort of liberated myself to move on and maybe write about other things. But I feel like for a first book, it was really important for me to explore some of these themes of growing up.
Yeah, and I mean, really do, down to the point of even identity and race and other things that happen. You're just riding your bike in Logan Square. I mean, there's a lot that goes into this. How as an author, how important is it for you to be able to live this story? You know, you lived it first.
Yeah. I think that, you know, the book is full of true stories, and I have this joke. I say this thing all the time when I'm reading, which is that like all my poems are true stories. And the reason that's kind of a joke is because a lot of the poems in the book have like time travel in them, or they have fantastic technologies. They take place in the past or the future, or they have people like flying around or doing things that could not be quote unquote true. Right. But I think part of the beauty of poetry is it allows us to expand our notion of what's possible and to see magic in the everyday world. So a lot of the book is things that I've actually lived, but it also gives me a chance to rewrite those narratives to be a little bit more magical.
You know, it's funny too, because reading it, I forget the piece where the old woman on the block yells at you.
Oh, yeah, one of the retelling poems.
And the racist approach, but the way you end the story or the poem is is as fantastical. It is this you know, it's a dream sequence of picking her up in a net and dropping her into Lake Michigan.
Yeah.
But it's told in a way that it is reality. It is truth.
Yeah.
That is what you were thinking at the time. Maybe not in that kind of prose, maybe not so poetic, but it is this idea that you would like to discard of this person who made you feel bad.
Yeah. And so that poem, there's three poems in the book that are that I call retellings. And each of them takes a true story of like a really racist incident that I encountered. So the one you're talking about is the first time I was ever called the N-word. So I was about 6 years old. I was riding my bike on my block. And
6 years old.
Yeah, 6 years old. I tell that story a lot because it makes me think about, you know, as you know, a lot of my research is about race and racism. And I feel like a lot of people don't realize at such a young age, children of color have to face race and racism and questions of race, even not just racism, just like identity. Like my first memory that has to do with race is when I was in kindergarten having a little girl, a little Mexican girl at my school come up to me and she was like, "Are you Mexican?" And she was excited that maybe I was also Mexican. Skin and we could both be friends, right? And I was like, no, sorry, you know. But I feel like a lot of times people don't realize how young we are as people of color when we have those experiences, when we have to start having those conversations. And a lot of adults are very uncomfortable having those conversations without realizing that for many people, it's not a privilege of choice that we get to have. But to go back to the poem, I think the reason I took that approach was because it allowed through poetry for me to kind of regain a sense of power and magic and fancy through rewriting a different ending, right? And that doesn't undo the violence and the
absolutely
horribleness
not, right?
and the trauma of what happened, but it allows me to end it a little bit differently.
Yeah, I enjoy that style of writing. I mean, there's
thank
something
you.
To say, okay, this happened. This is a pretty nasty thing that happened to you. And at 6 years old, riding your bike, you know, you can empathize. Right away, you're just like, this is terrible. This
yeah.
should not be happening.
Now, you want to know the real story of how that
absolutely.
Incident ended? So so the woman said to me, she came up to me and started yelling at me. And I was riding my bike on the sidewalk because I was in first grade. So she yelled at me that I should like move my bike out of the way. And she called me the N-word. And then she was like, "Go back to your Jesse Jackson neighborhood," right? And I went in the house and I said, like, "Mom, this lady, she told me go back to my Jesse Jackson neighborhood." And my mom was like, "I wish we lived in Jesse Jackson's neighborhood." She's like, "Jesse Jackson is rich, okay?" I was like, "Oh, okay." You know, so that was her actual response, which I've always
That's
thought was really hilarious.
That's a great response.
There was like no shame.
Eve Ewing is my guest tonight. Her debut book is out right now. Electric Arches is the name. She'll be reading from it at Loyola University Chicago on Thursday up in Rogers Park on the Rogers Park campus at 6 p.m. It's free. You can find out all the other events at eveewing.com. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll continue the conversation. Eve Ewing at the Big Table. Stay with us. My guest tonight at the Big Table, Eve Ewing. A poet, commentator, sociologist. She is currently with the University of Chicago School of Social Service Administration, but her debut book is out now. It's called Electric Arches. It's wonderful. And I'm not just saying that since I've known you since you're 10 years old, but I am saying
yeah,
that.
Your check is in the mail for the cosign. Thank you.
Eve will be reading from the book at Loyola University, the Rogers Park campus on Thursday, 6 o'clock, free reading, eveewing.com. We're talking about her book, but also just, I mean, you've had a tremendous run here where you got back from Harvard and it's just been, I wonder what Eve thinks of what's happening in Chicago. You know, I mean,
yeah.
You become
Isn't
a
that weird?
You become a voice for the voiceless. I mean, whether it be school reform and what's happening with CPS. And I mean, you did so much work and you've done professional work on the school closings in Chicago a couple years
Thank
back.
You.
And then also, I mean, just all the different social injustices we've had in Chicago over the years. I mean, you kind of are coming of age at the right time.
Yeah, I think so.
I don't know if that's a good thing, but...
I think so. Yeah, I've been really lucky, and I think it's a lot of things coming together, but, you know, one thing I think about a lot is this quotation from Arundhati Roy, and she's like, "There's no such thing as the voiceless. There's only the deliberately silenced or the preferably unheard." Mm. You know, and so, like... A lot of times people are keen to hear things that I have to say because I have Harvard next to my name, or because I have University of Chicago next to my name, or because, you know, I've published like in these prestigious places like the New Yorker or New York Times or whatever. But what I always remind people is, like, when I was a CPS teacher, nobody cared what I thought about anything. And I had the exact same opinions, ideas, skills. You know, I picked up a thing or two in graduate school. So I'm not trying to say like I was exactly the same person. But I always feel like, you know, I hope that in listening to the things I have to talk about, it will encourage people to also pivot and think about where our collective knowledge lies as a community, and how many young people have things to talk about, how many teachers, activists, right, have this wisdom.
I mean, you've been talking about these things, and whether people wanted to listen.
Right.
You've been talking about it since high school.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's
true. I mean, so talk about that. Talk about the idea of why, a perfect example, why CPS teacher? Why'd you want to be a teacher?
Oh, you know, because so when I was in college, I used to work at this thing called the Neighborhood Schools Program. Shout out to them. And I worked in a first grade class and a second grade class. And I realized like how intellectually challenging and amazing it is to be an educator. And so when I got to college, I had a bunch of other plans. And initially, I was actually going to join the Peace Corps and go teach abroad. And then I lived abroad for a while, and I realized, like, I don't want to do this at all. I want to go back home. Maybe they need teachers at home. Like, maybe you don't have to travel to some other country to teach, right? And I love being a teacher because, on the one hand, it's like incredibly hard and also incredibly fun. It's so challenging. It's like the most amazing strategy puzzle you could ever do. It's so rewarding. And I also just took it seriously in the sense of, you know, when you're a public school teacher, it means that like the people of this city are trusting you with their taxpayer dollars and sending their children to you and saying, be my partner in helping me raise my kid to be the kind of person that I want.
You think about that as a teacher.
I thought about that all the time. I had a parent, she wrote to me once and said, you know, she asked me for advice at something and I gave her some advice. And she said, thank you for helping me raise my son. You know, and I was like 22 years old. I was so profoundly moved by that this person would entrust their greatest gift to me. And so, you know, a lot of times as a teacher, people would just say stuff like, oh, you're a saint, or it must be so hard. Or people have a lot of stereotypes about public school teachers. But to me, it's like the greatest privilege I've ever had in my life. I love teaching. I love middle school, especially middle school, man. I think middle school is just the best.
You were able to get a vantage point on not only what a teacher goes through.
Yeah.
But the political and social climate around it, meaning, everything that's happening at the time that you're in schools. I mean, you're talking about CPS.
I'm like the Forrest Gump. Like when I started at CPS, Arne Duncan was
right.
Who I saw in Millennium Park today. I saw him walking down. I was like, is that Arne? Or is it just some other like 7 foot
really tall,
awkward dude? looks like the president of the 4-H club or something, you know? So I think I didn't say hi. He doesn't know who I am. But anyway, I started out with Arne. And then we had Ron Huberman, and then we had like this huge budget crisis. And that was partially why I decided to leave the classroom, was I became fascinated. There's always a perennial budget crisis, right? So this was years ago, and we had a budget crisis just as we, you know, this year we kind of have handled some things. But, you know, I started to think like, well, why is this happening? And who are the people that make these decisions? Because I come to work every day and the kids come here. This is their work, right? And the people in this building are working really hard. I have amazing colleagues. We have a great principal. Everybody from the engineer to the cafeteria person to the parent volunteers, all doing their best, right? So who are these people? Where are they? And why are they making these decisions that lead it to feel like the building is crumbling around us?
And
you know?
Also, I would say, to an extent, not being challenged on those decisions.
There was
a time, and you and I both know this, where you would have a CEO at CPS just sort of make decisions on turnaround schools or what they were going to do with curriculum or move things around. And there wasn't this fervor as we kind of have today in 2017.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think part of that, I left the classroom even though I loved what I was doing because I wanted to understand that power structure a little bit better. And it was harder to do when my nose was to the grindstone. But I think that even though now we have a lot more public criticism, and I think that a lot the journalism community in Chicago, activist community in Chicago, do a good job of holding CPS accountable. You know, the bottom line is we have an oligarchy, right? We have an autocracy. We have a mayor who appoints the CEO, There's no approval process. Nobody votes on that. Appoints the members of the board, right? No approval process. Nobody votes on that. And there's not a clear sense of accountability. And, you know, I feel like I believe that if we're going to have a democratic system, we should have democratically elected representatives. I can vote for the person who helps make sure that my water is clean, right? I can vote for the streets and sand guy, but I can vote for my alderman, but I can't vote for the people that are going to lead the path to a good education, quality education in the city. To me, that's messed up.
You spent a lot of time, and I it's on the top of my brain. I can't remember the name of it, but it was either a dissertation or it was a program you're working on, sort of taking a really close look at the closings. The
Chicago
Public
School. Second book. I just finished it.
So that's your second book.
Yeah,
that's great.
It's 2018.
2018. But it was really about looking at the issues of race.
Yeah, exactly.
And inequality and what we know when Chicago undertook the biggest closings of public schools in the nation's history.
Yep. Yep.
I mean, when you think about that, when you're a writer and a commentator, and you're involved and you've had the experience of being a teacher. And what is your first glimpse on how that kind of went down? And as time moves away from it,
right,
how it will be remembered?
Well, I'm going to shamelessly promote this book because I just finished it. It was like a lot of work, and I felt like I was crawling through thick mud trying to finish this book. But my second book is called When the Bell Stops Ringing, and it's about that topic. It's about the school closures. And it'll be out next year, but the short, and hopefully we can have another conversation
then.
Yes,
we don't want to. Right.
But the short version of it is that, in my opinion, and through my kind of analysis, the school closures in 2013 were the tip of an iceberg that went much deeper and had a much longer history, right? And that is a history that has to do with the forces that make this city the way it is. And that includes primarily segregation, right? That includes having a two-tiered system where everybody doesn't get the same resources, right? And it also has to do with what we were just talking about, which is a power structure, decision-making structure that is very remote oftentimes from the people on the ground who face the consequences of those decisions. And so to me, it's an important story to tell because I think that there's a way where when people are fighting for their schools, it's very easy to dismiss schools, these schools like, oh, these are bad schools. These are failing schools. Right. Rather than step back and ask the question, number one, why are these schools such important institutions in these communities? And number two, if a school is quote unquote failing, right, where does the buck stop? Where is the accountability for that? The thing that actually inspired me to write this project that I've been working on since 2013 is that Barbara Bird Bennett, wherever she may be right now, Barbara Bird Bennett, Barbara Bird Bennett, who of course was the CEO of CPS at that time in 2013, she gave the speech in front of the board where she said, these schools are under-resourced. They're underutilized and under-resourced. And I was like, it's your job to pass out the resources, right? If I'm a teacher and I don't give kids a pencil or paper or supplies, and I'm like, you can't take your test because you're under-resourced, right? Where's your pencil at? It's like, you're, as one person I interviewed for the book put it, it's like they poured gasoline on your house and then they're mad at you that it caught on fire, right? And so, yeah, that's what that book is about. And I feel like, I hope it'll be a good way of thinking about a lot of issues that are not just about schools, but about how the city works.
I love it
that
we're having a conversation about two books.
Yeah,
two books.
I started my third book, man. You're not ready. You're not ready.
I'm not ready. Eve Ewing in studio.
I gotta eat.
The author.
I gotta eat, fam.
She's written several books. Her debut book is out right now, Electric Arches. She will be reading from it at Loyola University Chicago on Thursday in Rogers Park, the Rogers Park campus. Free reading. You can get all the information at eveewing.com. All right, we'll take a break.
Cool.
We'll get tonight's news, and we'll continue the conversation right on the backside with Eve Ewing. Stay with us.
Sweet.
Thanks, Rob. It's Download Here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight at the big table, Homegrown.
Homegrown hero.
Homegrown hero. Poet, artist, commentator, sociologist, Eve Ewing. She got her debut album.
Yeah, my debut album.
It is kind of a debut album.
Sure.
Electric Arches. She'll be reading from the book at Loyola University Chicago coming up on Thursday at the Rogers Park campus. You can get all the information because she is busy. EveEwing.com. You know, as a lot of what you write about in this book, and it is a book of poetry. I guess it's poetry first, right?
Yeah. I mean, sure. I actually liked how you described it.
It's poetry, but it's also, it's got a lot of other things going on.
It's a book of stuff.
It's a book of stuff.
It's a bunch of stuff.
I'm fascinated, too, because you write a lot of about your personal life. I mean, you talk about your parents and you talk about your brother and your niece. And how important is it for you as a writer to have that personal connection? I mean, because you could write about social justice, you could write about schools, you can write about your own experiences. But how important is it for you to write about your family and your relationships?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I feel like I leave a lot out, like compared to a lot of poets and just a lot of writers. I've never been a person who writes like deeply confessional memoirs and stuff like that. I feel like I keep
that's
a lot
your fourth
of things.
Book.
Yeah, right. That's like once I no longer care about what anyone thinks. That's like when I'm 90, I'm just going to be like, let me tell you what this person said in 1992, you know. But I do think that like it's really important to ground things in specific stories. And so, you know, one piece of feedback I give to a lot of poets is like sometimes you go to open mic and someone will be like, this poem is about police brutality. Police brutality is bad for this reason and this reason, right? And then it's just like a list of things. And I think that what people need to ground themselves in a piece of literature like this is a story, right? And so I always tell people, this is why we tell young people, like, write what you know. Mm-hmm. Write what's true to you. Write what happened to you. Write about the time that you were on the bus and you got pulled off the bus by a cop and, like, taken, you know? And so I think that for me, I'm telling these specific stories about my family as a way of entering, like, broader themes or broader subjects. And to a certain extent, like, you know, you're creating a universe in the poem. And so the people in the poems, they're my family, but they're also like a character or a version of a person that's much more complicated or three-dimensional than on the page.
Well, knowing your family and knowing your mother and the poem that you're writing about their relationship, your mother and your father, and that she was playing tambourine in a Chaka Khan cover band was awesome.
Isn't that hilarious?
Information I did not know.
Yeah, I only found that out like 2 years ago. But see, that's a great example, right? So that poem's called Origin Story, right? Which is kind of riffing off my nerdishness, right? It's like my superhero origin story. It's about my parents meeting. But like, I know that story. I know my parents met at a Greyhound bus station. I like all the details of that story are true, but I obviously wasn't there. And I also haven't, it's not like I went and interviewed them or asked them about it, right? This is like a construction of my own mind based on.
It's like an arrangement of a story.
Yeah, it's an arrangement of a story. And really what it's about is like, what does love mean when, you know, my parents got split up when I was 4 years old, right? And they have a good relationship with each other and I have a good relationship with each of them. So what does love mean in that context, right? And it was kind of inspired by meeting people and be like, how'd your parents meet? They'd be like, my parents met in college and they fell in love and now they've been married for 30 years. I was like, awesome, my parents met at the bus station. You know? My dad was selling comic books.
The last line, I mean, you say a love like that doesn't last, but it has a good ending.
Yeah.
And I just, there's something true to that. I mean, that right there resonates regardless of the story or who it's about, if it's about your parents or it's about.
Yeah.
But the idea that you hear that all the time, a love like that doesn't last.
Yeah.
But to say it has a good ending, I mean, there's something that, I mean, not to be so cliche, but there's beauty in those words.
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you so much. And, you know, I think that part of the book is like trying to complicate easy stories, right? And so my parents have been together for 50 years and they're married and they've always been in love with each other. That's an easy story. That's not my story. You know, I have to account for the fact that like my birth is a result of two people once loving each other, that now it's very difficult for me to ever imagine why they were in a relationship or why anyone thought that was a good idea. Right. But I can't unwish it because then I wouldn't be born.
But it also makes you who you are.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And that's important as a writer to be true to the story of who you are, not what you wanted to be.
Yeah, well, thank you.
All right, so let's talk about, I mean, there's so much to talk about, Eve, but I want to get into, I mean, you spent time and I'm fascinated because you got your PhD at Harvard, and there's stories from Boston. And they are very, they mirror a lot of the stories in Chicago when it comes to race and identity. But I mean, you know, being in Boston, what was that experience like being a Chicagoan who you were starting to identify what your voice was? You were starting to become you were a poet in Boston. I remember following you in Boston, but you almost becoming a Boston poet.
Yeah.
Or a Boston commentator where you were from, Chicago.
Well, I'm so grateful for that experience because, you know, I always thought I would go away for college and, you know, I stayed here. I grew up here. And then I decided to go to University of Chicago. And then I became a CPS teacher. Right. And so all of a sudden I got to this point in my young adulthood where on the one hand, I was very worldly, like I had traveled a lot or whatever and had a lot of different experiences. But on the other hand, I had lived in the city my whole life. And it was very difficult for me at first to transition to another place. Boston, in many ways, is like a difficult city to get to know. And even just practical stuff, like there's no grid, right? It's like very twisty turny. It's a very old city. There's hills, right? They're like all these different things that just different culture, different social expectations. I remember I felt super Midwestern when I had this neighbor across the street from me. And he was this like really loud guy, and he would stand in front of his house all the time and kind of yell at people from his porch. So it was clear to me, like, this guy is the neighbor, right? Like, this is the guy. I need to get this guy on my side, you know? And he would stand there, his super thick Boston accent. So I made all these cookies, and I, you know, I'm not going to say I made the cookies for him, but suffice it to say,
I had some
surplus cookies, you know? So I put the cookies.
That's a life lesson. Always have surplus cookies.
Always have a
right?
little extra, right? So I put these cookies in a bag, and I went across. I was like, hey, I make these cookies. You know, would you like? And he's like, nah. No, thanks. And I was like, oh, well, he's like, yeah, I have diabetes. I was like, well, you know, do you want maybe someone else in your house? He's like, no.
What about the gesture, sir?
Right. I was just like, where I come from, you know, I don't care if the cookies are like visibly disgusting, right?
You take
like
them.
You take them. Right. Go throw. Do you not have a trash? Throw them in the trash, bro. You don't have friends, you know? So that's when I was like, oh, this place is so different. You know what I mean? But it really grew on me, and it was really nice to have an opportunity to have like a basis of comparison. So it helped me appreciate things about where I was from that mm-hmm. I had taken for granted. And it also helped me, you know, see the world a little bit bigger and see that a lot of the issues that we face are the same. And that's also helped me in my writing because, you know, a lot of times when I write about Chicago, I write in these national outlets and people read them and they're like, that's Detroit. Oh, we have the same problem in Baltimore.
Interesting.
That's happening with us right now in Philly, right? And it makes you realize that we do have these systemic problems that are happening across the country that we can have some useful conversations and think about building solidarity. So I have a lot of love for Boston, and it really grew on me. I also learned to really like oysters, so that was part
so
of it.
So that worked out.
Yeah, I don't eat oysters in Chicago. I'm like, I don't know where this came from.
You became an oyster snob.
Yeah, I just the origins are so unclear. Like, there's no way that you could. One time I was like, where's this oyster from? They're like, it's fresh. I'm like, that's physically impossible. This is not possible, okay? So stop telling me lies.
It was fresh on a UPS
right,
plane.
Right, fresh from the Jewel. Yeah. Right. Fresh from Jewels.
Eve Ewing's my guest at the big table tonight, talking about her new book, Electric Arches. Identity plays a big role. And this is something that I think that you have excelled at as a commentator, as a sociologist. The idea of sort of examining who we are and where we're from.
Mm-hmm.
And race plays a big part of that, but also equality and inequality and identity.
Yeah,
and where do you belong? And what is it about that concept as a writer and as an advocate and a commentator? What is it about that concept that draws you in?
You know, I think that we all have to understand where we come from to understand where we're going, you know? And I think that it's really easy to get on autopilot and not think about the ways that the world we live in has shaped us based on who we are. And I think that that also happens when you're in a position of privilege, right? So, for example, I was born in the United States, right? I didn't ask to be born in this country. It means that I have a citizenship that I did not earn, right? And when I listen to other writers, friends that are immigrants, friends that are undocumented, talk about what their experience is like, it makes me realize how much of that experience I've taken for granted. And oftentimes when you have a form of identity that carries a privilege with it, you see it as invisible, right? Mm. So you can walk through your whole life not thinking about what
Absolutely
it means to be
right.
white, not
right.
thinking about
right.
what it means to be straight, not thinking about what it means to not have a disability, right? Or to be a cis person, or, you know, to be born in the United States. And I think that in order for us to effectively love and care for one another, we have to be able to have those conversations.
Or understand each other.
Just understand each other on a basic level, right?
Reverend Bedell, who's coming up here, he's going to be my guest at 9 o'clock.
Yeah, that sounded real lightweight.
Yeah, really lightweight. But a big part of what he did for the Obama administration was faith-based. It was about religions being on college campuses, people of different religious faith, and to be able to learn how to talk to each other and learn how to understand each other. That far too often our identity gets in the way. Our identity becomes a card that says, I don't need to talk to you because I have this identity. Or, right. Or I don't need to understand where you're coming from because I'm this.
Because I'm from here. Right. And I think that, you know, there are always going to be things we don't understand about each other. There are always going to be limits to how much we can, you know, walk in another person's shoes or understand their experience. But at the very least, I feel like when we start through understanding ourselves, it gives us a good position to start having those conversations in an honest way, and to lead with love, right? To lead with the idea that I don't need to fully encompass every aspect of your life in order to love you, celebrate you, and try to be by your side as you face what you're facing. So that's why, I mean, and to be honest with you, the other reason why I talk about identity a lot, Toni Morrison has this great quote that I'll paraphrase, but basically like, write the book you want to read, right? So to a certain extent, this book is the book that I would have really loved to read when I was 14 or 15 or 16 years old. And I think that we're having this conversation now as a society about representation in media. And I think that people really underestimate how important it is, right? And what it means that, like, you know, that young people of color very often don't get to see themselves, ourselves, in just positions of just doing regular stuff, right? And being heroes, right? Saving the world, or like going to school, or having a history that is outside of just a history of oppression. And I just think people underestimate how important that is.
Well, and I love the fact that you're in a position where you can call that out. And you use social media in that way. Twitter is a great example.
I'm on Twitter 29 hours a day.
and I love it because a lot of it is pushback. A lot of it is pushing back on the lowercase n-word narrative, right? which you know, is this idea that more and more we're hearing about a story is somebody's story. It's not everybody's story.
Right,
And there's this pushback on making sure that the media, us talking right now, or reporters, understand that several different people in this country see things differently. And we've run into a brick wall in this country when you just think about how conservatives and liberals talk to each other. But it gets even worse when you start talking about different ethnicities and the idea, like you just mentioned, the idea that many stories just omit the narrative of brown people,
right,
or minorities, or anyone who's who's oppressed.
Yeah, and I think the thing I'd like to remind people is, like, we just do regular stuff too, right? So one of my favorite TV characters, like, ever is Glenn from The Walking Dead. He's this Korean-American guy who fights zombies, right? And he becomes this action hero, right? And it's not just that he's a Korean-American guy on TV, but he's a Korean-American guy on TV, like, fighting zombies, you know? And I just think that that's so important. And, you know, I have my good friend, Fatima Oscar. She just wrote this web. Yeah. You should have her on the show.
No,
she's
amazing. Sonia Denis, who did who was the actress.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, you know, about the show Brown Girls, and it's going to be on HBO.
Yep.
And, you know, Fatih is a queer Muslim South Asian woman. And the show is about all of that. But it's also about, like, dating, and like, you like this person, but you can't really tell them because you also like this other person. You're not ready for a relationship.
Right. It doesn't lead with it, and that's what makes it great. And that's the conversation we had, right? This idea that doesn't lead us. It's not a show about ethnicity. It's not a show about, it's called Brown Girls.
Right.
But in it,
They're just doing stuff. People of color, that's our tagline for 2018. We just do stuff, you know? And when
when
I was
you go on Netflix, that's what it says.
Yeah,
just doing,
people
stuff.
Doing stuff.
People doing stuff.
When I was a kid, my mom, she used to come to my school and, like, read, you know, sometimes volunteer and read. And she always liked to read this book called Mirandy and Brother Wind, which is a picture book about this little girl. And she participates in a cakewalk competition in her community. And she always said she liked to read it to my class because she felt like my classmates only saw black kids in books, like marching with Martin Luther King or like in slavery, right? And she didn't want them to think that, like, that is all of black history, right? And that we don't just do regular stuff too, you know? And so I just think that those diverse narratives are really important.
Do you see it, you know, as you are an adult yourself now? It's just hard for me to say.
Oh, no.
But do you see it getting any better? Do you see that because of your voice and other voices like you, even some of the women that you mentioned here, that there are more representation when it comes to narratives in news and media?
I do. I really do. And I mean, I remember, you know, my parents' generation, folks always talk about, like, if they saw a black person on the news, they would run to the TV, you know? So I think it's getting better. And I also feel like, you know, Ava DuVernay, she's making this Wrinkle in Time movie, and the main character is a little black girl. I saw the trailer and I just started crying, and it was hard for me to even imagine if I had seen that when I was 9 years old. But then I also think it's not It's not just a question of like a black and white narrative. I think it's something that we are going to continually have to work on as a society, because it's also like, well, you know, where are trans people? Where are people with disabilities, right? Where are people who are at the intersections of these different identities? Right now, you know, in black activist circles, it's important for people to be like, well, you know, you all forget people with disabilities exist at these protests and things like that. How are you going to make it accessible? You know, for me and Twitter, I've been pushed a lot to think about how, if I have a reading that I really like, I want to share a screenshot. A person who's blind and is using a screen reader can't access that, right? And it's not up to me to just be like, well, it's inconvenient for me to do something differently. So I think that it's really important for us to expand our thinking about identity. And a lot of times when people hear stuff like that, they're like, oh, so we just have something different for everybody, or how are you gonna do that? Everybody gets their own thing. No, but just recognize that people around you exist, right? And whether or not you choose to acknowledge different people's existence, they're still out here living life, and you are missing out on their wonder and their beauty and everything that they can contribute, because you're making the world inaccessible and scary to them, you know? And so, to me, a world in which we have all these different stories is not like some kind of an inconvenience. It's not about a quota that we have to fill. It's just about making a richer, more beautiful artistic world that reflects the real world in which we live.
And it's reflected in the new debut book from Eve Ewing. It's called Electric Arches. It's out now. It's a book of poetry, prose, short stories, some art as well. Eve, who is a former CPS teacher who got her PhD from Harvard, is now at the University of Chicago School of Social Service Administration. She is going to be reading from the book, a free reading, at Loyola University of Chicago, the Rogers Park campus, coming up on Thursday, 6 p.m. It's free, and she's also got a slew of other events coming up this month. You can find it all at eveewing.com. Eve, oh, man, total pleasure.
What a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Great to see you.
Such a joy.
Congrats.
Have a great night.